Today for Tributaries, we've got a clip from my podcast on regenerative agriculture. These guests are literally digging in and leading the way toward a future our ancestors understood. And they're great life stories. Regenerative agriculture movement is gaining ground, and inclusivity is at the core, and I'm kind of blown away at the generosity of this collective, and today's guests are no exception. Megan Lannan runs Barney Creek Livestock in Montana with her husband Pete, and they are driving the regenerative movement from their land into the entire region, and her partnership with Nicole Masters is circulating new thought around the globe. Our next guest is Chloe Parker from Parker Pastures in Gunnison, Colorado. She's a second-generation rancher who poses the question, do you want to know exactly where your meat comes from and reconnect with the land and your food source? Well, I guess since you're tuned in for Cultivated Audio September 2023, the answer is yes. I'm Robin. Grab some earbuds and or a shovel and let's dig in. Megan, tell us about Barney Creek livestock operation on your family's ranch, the Jordan Ranch, where it is, acreage geography, just an overall what type of livestock you have or what you grow.
Barney Creek Livestock is located in Livingston, Montana. We're about 14 miles outside of Livingston in the Paradise Valley. So we're a part of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. So we've got a big responsibility and a lot of things to pay attention to. We run on leases. So we have 5 leases that total a little under 1,000 acres. And so we graze our cows for folks that want to bring back their ecosystem. So a little bit of a different model. Where the operation is located is on the Jordan Ranch lease. That is Pete's parents. That was our first lease that we operated with. And they have just a little under 200 acres. And so we usually finish all the beef back here, and that leads me into our direct-to-consumer beef operations. As a product of bringing back the ecosystem, we've got awesome beef to sell, and so we are Audubon certified. Our cows are Audubon certified because of the way we move, which is a little bit different for Audubon, and we raise black and red Angus, and we have, it depends, 100, 100-plus, depending on the time of year. That's how many we run.
Right. So let's just start with the ranch of Pete's parents. I know you both are very committed to the regenerative system of doing things. Is this the way that land or that ranch was always treated?
No. Pete's dad grew up on this piece of land, and it has always been something. So they ran sheep. They had a dairy, and they've had a beef operation. He grew hay and cut hay and sold hay for a while. He also did that. And then he decided he was going to retire, and he did for a little bit. And then he ended up getting cancer and came up to Pete and said, hey, I want to run cows again. So that's really how Pete and I got back into it, was because his dad wanted to. And then his dad got through cancer and decided, I don't want to run cows. Pete and I decided, well, we'll keep going. And so that's kind of where we're at with all that.
Oh, that's so great. I have a friend who got cancer and decided to learn the ukulele, and he got through his cancer. Oh. And now he's still playing ukulele. So it's a good lesson, isn't it? You've got to keep a good attention and keep interested in something. There's more to life than any one thing. How did you move on looking at the land? What was the first thing that you decided, okay, well, we've really got to get a handle on this and move from there into different pieces of a regenerative system? But what was staring at you in the face first?
Well, when we first got these cows, Pete started reading a lot because it wasn't going to work in the traditional manner. In the way that they had run those cows, which was graze them, but then grow hay, cut the hay, then we've got hay. And the reason for that we were not able to keep that part of the model going, was one, because we knew it was a significant amount of inputs. And then two, Pete at the time was a Forest Service smoke jumper at West Yellowstone Smoke Jumper Base in West Yellowstone, Montana. And so he was jumping and also was the base manager there. So he just couldn't get back here to cut hay and run the equipment. And then our kids were pretty little at the time too. So we had to figure out a way where we could really use the cows and feed them and also regenerate the land. So Pete started doing a lot of reading, just surmised from those books that it might not be the best way, but it's the way we've got to do it. So when we really started regenerating, it really came from, this is what we have to do. It didn't really come from for love of dung beetles or soil or conservation or anything like that. It really was, this is the way we've got to do things. We started doing that. Our first employee was an FFA high school guy. He was awesome. And I just thought about him a couple weeks ago. I'm going to cry. I thought about him a couple weeks ago because I was like, wow, I think when he started, he thought we were crazy.
Oh, no.
Because he was like, we're just moving these cows on. There's not a whole lot here. And how is this really going to help? And oh, man, if you could see it now. So I think that when we walk around here and look at where we started, just when all this was kind of new to us, I know that a lot of HMI folks have been doing it for a long time, but wow, I don't think we'd go back. All the changes in the land, the wildlife, the birds, the insects, the amount of insects that we have, it's like walking in a natural zoo every day. It's phenomenal.
What year was that he started? So how many years are we talking now?
I want to say it was 2016.
That's amazing.
And because Pete's dad had done such a great job here, he didn't spray a whole lot of any chemical.
Right.
So we started off in a pretty good spot. It was just, working with the land and getting to know its systems and working with it, not trying to manipulate it. So this piece in particular that I'm talking with the high school student was up on a hill that had only been flood irrigated. And so just working that land in those areas where the water hadn't reached and the timing and getting the grass to come back and stuff was a bit of a dance. That was probably the one piece that was really like, okay, we're doing it. This works. This is great.
So moving the cattle was a big initial piece then for you?
Yeah. When we first started doing this, Pete's dad said, I'll give you 20 acres to try this on. We're like, okay. So we had no idea what we were doing with fencing. We've gone through a bunch of different iterations and equipment there, but just started moving them every day and looking at what worked and what didn't, like in terms of spacing and how we were going to do this. Pete, because of all the reading and the research he was doing, he's like, I think I'm going to try and get him an equip cost share to the NRCS. And so he applied and we got it and we were able to put in a bigger pump and then put in a wheel line on that flood irrigated piece that I talked about. And that really changed the game for us. And then adding that bigger pump allowed us to really run. We have two pivots on this lease. And so run those pivots either at the same time, one at a time, run our other big guns, we call them, or K lines or two wheel lines we have on this property. So basically that's why we finished beef here, is because all summer we're just moving like crazy, moving water and growing grass. That's all we do here, because then we stockpile it for the winter so we can finish beef here in the spring. And then in the winter, we can have them here for a bit and stockpile that grass.
So what were some of the first thing you noticed with the cattle for all your efforts with the grass and rebuilding that land?
I think the first thing we noticed, well, we thought we'd try it as just a grand experiment, is to just minimize worming. We used to pour wormer, and so we just got to the point where we thought maybe with moving them all the time, it might reduce. They're going to have a natural worm load anyway, but to reduce, some of that by movement. And we did see that happen, and we haven't had to pour wormer. We've always left it open, that if, animal health is a priority for us.
Sure.
So if there were signs of that, then we would do that. But I think with this constant movement, we've been able to just keep that on hand, but not have to use it. We do follow Joel Salatin's method that looks like they are getting pretty wormy. He uses Shackley soap. And so we've tried that, and that's been really successful. He'll pour some of that in their water, and then they drink that, and then it flushes the worms out. So we've done that in the past, but we haven't had to do that for a couple of years.
That's great.
Yeah.
Before we can do something differently, we oftentimes need to think differently. And what can you offer here? The regenerative system is certainly a web of connection. And we go from the mechanistic of the industrial age into this web of life. It's a different method, isn't it? It's a whole different thing, really. You've been so successful with your farming and your ranching, and we'll talk a little bit later about what you're doing with Nicole Masters and your classes. It's different to look at something from a holistic point of view.
Yeah, you know, Pete and I give a lot of tours here, and I think the number one thing we mentioned, because it seems like when folks really get started down this regenerating path, and I think it's just a human thing, we start to see other places and other people's operations and start to almost solve things. I think that's human nature to solve. And so whenever we give a tour here, what we've always put in the center of that web almost is context. And then on the outside, you know, you've got everything from your family that comes into that, your community that comes in, your animals, the soil, you know, all those things that are around that web. And so we always explain to people that everybody's context is different. You could be in Brazil, it's going to be different. You could be down the road and your neighbor's context is going to be different. And just valuing that context and knowing that those folks are doing the best that they can do within that system. Then we start to talk about here when we're running in our context, we think about all the points on that web. And we talk about a web. And if you pull one side, it's going to affect the other. And so when we make operational decisions, we try to think of, you know, how that might, again, affect that whole system. A lot of folks will say, there's no way we could do this. We could never do what you're doing. So Pete will say, well, you're right. And they look at him like, seriously?
You're right. Just go home now.
Yeah. Beat it. You've already made up your mind that you can't. And so if they're interested, and we talked about, well, you know, what are just the little things? What if you just moved your horses every day? That's a little something. It's given back to that system. You know, it's just kind of breaking it apart again and not looking for a silver bullet, but being able to go out there and try some things and fail small.
Right.
Learn big.
Beautiful. Yeah.
That's also a large part of this. Yep.
Yeah, that's really great. By doing that, you're really putting yourself in that picture too, right? It's very easy to get burned out doing anything, but especially farming and ranching, because everything is nonstop all the time. So that's really beautiful what you said. I appreciate that, and appreciate that for everyone. And you've been doing that great work with Nicole Masters as well.
It's almost the level before mental health, I feel like, when we've been training and leading people through this. And we'd come up with this idea to do this training. And we wrote a SARE grant, and they funded it, this one in Denver, October 9th and 10th in Denver. And it's on the Integrity Soil site. And then we'll be putting it online as well. We're going to film it.
Bravo.
We tried it. We tested it out in Australia first, and we walked away and we're like, man, I mean, we're really onto something. This is something that people want and need. And I think it goes back to, if we're going to make it the next 50 years. And I think you said it best, is that we are in the ecosystem and we are a huge part of that. It's almost the level before mental health. I feel like when we've been training and leading people through this, and it's not only learning how to get out of the way of nature, but also how to stay in the game. You know, if we're not healthy, the land isn't healthy either.
The one thing that I would love too, which I think is part of this that you've figured out, is I'd love to impress onto our listeners to hear and to share, is how you've gotten landowners to participate in your project. Basically, you're helping them to regenerate their land. Was that a hard sell? What did that look like?
we decided, wow, we need more grass because a big part of regenerating is resting. So we needed to rest this lease, and we were like, we need to find more land. We started asking around, and a lot of our context and where we live in the Paradise Valley, there are affluent landowners. Sometimes this is their either second home here in the valley, or sometimes their fourth. We're just trying to think, well, let's get to the bottom of why did they buy land here, right? And it was because it's beautiful and because of the wildlife. We just started opening conversations about, here's what we do. Here's what our cows can do for you, explaining that when we're on a lease, how we move them every day, if it's a really big lease, because of, you know, we're all about inputs. So our time and our labor and when we can get to certain places might be 3 to 5 days on bigger pieces.
Right.
But making those areas where the cows are bigger and really keep an eye on the land. But was explaining to them, here's why we're doing this and here's the benefits for you. And the other thing that we really like to do is we make them a part of that team. And so we're explaining their soil, what the cows are doing, how they're moving. We talked about microbiology. We talked about water movement and infrastructure, how we build infrastructure on those leases and why it's a little bit different. And so I hope that they would say that they're learning along with us. And
sure.
So they really do become a team member. And I think that feels a little bit different for them. And I'm sure there are a lot of people out there that probably do that. But just the feedback that we get is that I just never knew that cows could do that.
And right,
I'm like,
right.
Yes, they're amazing. So I've got one landowner that she's part of a FAIR grant with us. We're regenerating her land. And I got 4 other producers to be a part of this project, which is putting native pollinator plant seed into the cow's mineral. And then they're digesting that seed and then pushing it out the back end and then planting it. We've done that a lot on a lot of our leases, and we know that that works. But we wanted to try that for pollinator flowers and
wow.
grasses and legumes to see work in sync with bees. So the bees get the first hit, you know, on that grass.
Yes.
Or those flowers, and then the cows get to come along and eat that as well. So using cows to work in that ecosystem, and this gal is really excited to see those flowers come up and to watch those bees, and of course she loves watching the cows. So getting them to work in partnership and be beneficial with each other. We'll see how it goes. We're on year 2 of the project. So
good planning and good idea on that. And between the educational weekends you teach and the interviews you're doing, are you ever left thinking, no one's asking me about this or questioning a current practice?
No, because I think, you know, what I'm finding is that when we talk about things, I think a lot of people are moving that way. I think sometimes they get stuck on what's the right way, what's the silver bullet, how can I be sure?
Right.
And so I think they know, and there's enough information out there to do these things. I think just sometimes they're just a little nervous maybe. And so I just always go back to just try something small, just try a corner. And then Pete will talk about, he's put fish through the pivots. He's put humic through the pivots. He's put molasses through the pivots. And so yeah. he's always excited to share, you know, how he's doing those things and how things are all right. He hasn't blown anything up or, so I think that reassurance and that, for people to know that they can always ask questions, and then we're always really honest about, again, that context, just what are your constraints or what are your opportunities, and how can you just try, again, something small.
Well, here we are about 50 years or so into the organic movement and certification and focus. This kind of proves that we needed to go further. You know, we needed to go beyond organic into sustainable and into a regenerative mindset and work. Can you imagine 50 years from now what we might be seeing or what might be needed?
Oh, man. Well, it makes me think of our kids. And so I guess I hope this really looking at the land and not treating nature as a widget, probably not grammatically correct, but working to work with it, to be in that system and to be paying attention and not pump out a, you know, I guess, a widget.
The plan is in really the observation.
Yeah. And just to really be paying attention about what nature's throwing at you, because it's going to be different.
Right.
We can't just get set in a practice right now because it worked. It's really observing and adapting, and that's the game, and resting. I think those are huge, huge principles, and I think that we'll still be able to be here. If farmers and ranchers don't really take a stand, I think we're just going to work and work and work and work really hard for the middle people to make the money, and then we'll still just be working. But I think we've got to take a stand and get really creative on maybe how we're doing, in our context, how we're doing leases, like getting really creative and figure out, you know, maybe it's not always paying per head on a piece of land or for a lease. Let's get creative with that. People that run goats and sheep in places for fire mitigation really have it figured out. I think they're really creative in those leases. And I think for us to still be here and for us to still work with the land, I think we really need to get creative and get paid for that work, because we're working really hard to get things out to the end of the supply chain. I think there's a great opportunity, and the time is now, to be paying attention and to bring those kids, the future, up into this sort of thinking. Get them to ranching for profit. Get them to be thinking about running their operations like a business, and get them to be thinking about their products as quality food, and how can we make that happen for their community. Feed their community first, then we'll worry about feeding the world. But let's do a really good job with our community first. And I think we've got a good opportunity to make it even better in the next 50 years.
Yes, absolutely. Are you finding that there's more government support in grants and that sort of thing that is helping this regen movement?
Well, yes and no. Our experience with the NRCS and our cost share was excellent. And I think because Pete, with his job, is really great at paperwork, because he works for the Forest Service, was really able to get through a lot of that. And so I'm sure the NRCS would have been there to help with a lot of that, but I just because of Pete and his skills, I think really got through that stuff. But I think that they're out there for sure. And I think that sometimes I wish we could carve out time in our farming, ranching schedule. And this is part of the ecosystem. This is part of working on your business and making this happen, but really seeking those out and really having the time. I know I've been wanting to do one with the state, and I was like, man, I asked people, I'm like, how many pages was that? And one of my friends,
right,
said, well, it was a 40-page grant. I was like, oh, God. Dang it. Okay. Well, I've got to get geared up for that. You know, I've got to be able to get some time. I wish there was a way.
Definitely.
And I know they have to get those questions answered and stuff like that. Yes, a really long answer to your question. I think it's just really going for it and getting those. I wish there were more grants or programs that funded infrastructure. There are a lot of places that there's a lot of infrastructure that's just dilapidated. I think that if smaller producers, because that's what we are, could get some assistance to pay for a scale, that would be one way to really help out small producers to build better corral systems,
yes,
you know, that might
yes.
follow more of a Temple Grandin
right,
sort
yes.
of setup. I mm-hmm. think that would be, oh, just so amazing. Our daughter who runs sheep, you know, plus she's under 18, which is also the other problem, but trying to figure out how to build a better system for her sheep, to load up her sheep and to pay for that. She pays for everything herself. So she has been amazing with pallets. She's built a lot with pallets. And I know there's a lot of ranchers or farmers that are over the age of 18 that have done the same thing. I think funding infrastructure would help a lot.
Megan, lastly, what's your favorite cut of beef?
Oh, wow. And I know this is going to sound crazy, but I really love, well, there's two. I really love osso buco and stew meat. Crazy. Pete would be like, are you kidding me? But I think they're the small champions of beef that, you know, for families and being creative with cooking, mm-hmm. not all small kids like a big old steak, but you can make a great stroganoff or stir fry with stew meat, and then also buco, just throw it in the crock pot. And, oh man, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Those are my favorite.
Chloe, give us an overview of your operation at Parker Pastures in Gunnison, geography, size of your ranch and herd, rainfall, and whatever else you feel falls into that category.
My name's Chloe Parker. I'm the owner and CEO of Parker Pastures. My parents founded Parker Pastures when I was little because they wanted to provide me and my brothers with the highest quality meat, but also raised in a way that was healing to the environment. And that's always been our core foundation. We're located in the pristine mountain valley of Gunnison, Colorado. We mainly do beef. We've really perfected the art and science of finishing cattle off of grass. And then we also work with some other local regenerative producers to provide our community with pork, chicken, and lamb.
How many in your herd of cattle?
It varies throughout the year, just kind of depending on growing season, but 500 to 1,000, just depending.
Sure. And what kind of rainfall do you get on average?
That's a very good question. We're definitely more in the desert. With our irrigation, we're able to have more moisture, but we are more in the desert and rely pretty much solely on snowfall and then rainfall.
Well, it's interesting, your website mentions how the unique expression of your ranch's terroir is magnified in the autumn, and I wonder if you could draw a little picture for us about that.
I like to think of the deer and elk. When the fall arrives, they're needing to put on fat for the winter, and the grass changes. It has more richness, and it's harder. So when those animals graze it, they convert that grass into fat a lot faster than they do in, say, the spring or early summer. So that's exactly what our cattle do as well. Just in the location that we're at and our environment, our grass just hardens. And what that does is that just makes our beef super, super marbled and also super flavorful. Hands down, our best beef is always in the fall because of those factors.
And you mentioned earlier that you've been really perfecting the finishing on grass. Can you share a little bit about what that was like, maybe a lesson you've learned that you've really been able to incorporate, and what really brought you to the place where you are today?
My dad spent pretty much all of his life learning about finishing cattle off of grass. There is a lot of art and science to it because you can't just turn a cow out into a pasture and then you get really good beef. It doesn't really work that way. And we also want to make sure we're doing it in a way that is healing and restoring the earth. So with those factors in mind, my dad has spent a lot of time and learning just how does one do that. And that knowledge he's passed on to me. And it's something that we're really proud of and we are very good at is finishing cattle off of grass. From different methods that we use, like our beef herd, the cattle we're fattening for beef, we graze them differently than some of our other cattle because we want them to get the best of our grass and we want to move them fast and we just want to have them graze the top part of the plant. We're taking that top one-third of the plant, and that result is we have beef that is well marbled and it's not tough and there is fat on it. And also it's super nutrient dense because our cattle graze hundreds of different plants throughout their lifetime and can tell it's nutrient dense because of how flavorful the beef is.
So when you're not finishing your herd, they're allowed to eat deeper into the plant that's growing on the field and they're not moved as much. Is that one of the differences you're talking about?
I wouldn't say that's necessarily the one that I point out. All of our cattle are very spoiled and they get the best of the best and we move them very often. I'd say when we're finishing cattle, just a little bit different approach, but even our cows and calves that we have, they are super, super fat because that's just kind of how we've managed our grass. That grass has a lot of nutrients and those cattle, just how we manage them, are able to fatten and grow, whether they are for beef or whether they're raising a calf.
Your pastures have an amazing amount of biodiversity, as you just mentioned. Was the fact that you have irrigation and you have a lot of the lovely snowmelt, which I think is very rich for growing anything, be it cattle or the land itself. Did that biodiversity come naturally, or did you really focus on creating that for your land?
That's a really good question. That's something that we have really focused on because a lot of land that is under our management, we started, most of it was a monocrop of mostly timothy grass or other grasses, and just how we've grazed our animals and just the principles we use of, like, we will graze the grass in the summer, we'll graze something really fast, but then we'll allow it a long time to recover and regrow, or we'll use a lot of animals in a tight space and then move them. Just some of those principles over time have created more biodiversity and lots of different species. But yeah, that's something we've definitely focused on, and it's not how it originally started. There was a lot more monocrops, and now we have red clover and white clover and so many different grasses. It's amazing to just go out in the pasture and see all of the different species.
And can you give us a little example of how often you are moving your cattle? I would assume that it's really different season to season, but even year to year. We've had a lot of moisture and rain here in the Boulder area of Colorado, and I believe it's been pretty much throughout the entire state. So are you finding a lot more growth in the grasses, so you're moving cattle less often, or how does that fit in with your year?
In the summer, we're definitely moving our cattle multiple times a week, sometimes even once a day, because when the grass is growing fast, there's a saying, fast growth, fast moves. So when the grass is growing fast, we want to graze it fast, get off of it fast, and then let it recover. Versus in the winter, when the grass isn't growing, our moves are a lot slower, slow growth, slow move. So it definitely depends a lot on what's going on, but we're definitely moving our cattle a lot. And I think something important in what we're doing is our way of life is important to us. We could move our cattle every 5 hours or something like that. But for us, with our way of life, that's not something that we feel like fits in our context. So a lot of those things depend on certain ranches and just other things that are going on. But to answer your question, yeah, definitely moving multiple times a week, once a day, just kind of depending on external factors.
How many people are actually working on your ranch?
In the summer, my dad and I, and we have some extra help. And then the winter, things kind of slow down. And then I also have some help with the Parker Pastures meat company as well.
And you're running Red Devon cattle, is that correct?
Yep, that is our mama herd of cattle, mostly Red Devon. And we chose those because they finish really well off of grass.
And what about with your climate and geography? Is that a breed that you've come to use, or have you always had those type of cattle?
As we got into the grass-fed beef business and just exploring what fits best, after a lot of research, Red Devon, they have been bred to finish off of grass. They haven't been bred to go into a feed yard and grow super, super fast, so it seems super fitting for us. I mean, we've had them for as long as I can remember. And just with our climate and what we're trying to achieve and do, they've been a great fit.
Now, when do you send them to slaughter? What age and what weight generally?
Definitely another variable thing. We kind of more go off of, do they, one thing we look for is like, do they have a bubble butt, which is just like a ton of fat right around their tailbone. And we're kind of more looking off of, are they super well marbled? Are they finished more than what age they are, or that sort of thing?
So you're using your eye more than a measurement. I like that.
Yeah.
The best farmers and ranchers are those with the best observational skills.
For sure.
something I read about you using biodynamic ranching, and I certainly know that term for farming and gardens. What is the application for ranching?
I would more say we're more on the restorative, regenerative side than biodynamic, but honestly, all those words kind of intermingle. How we care for our animals and how we care for our land is our core foundation, because if we don't have healthy land and healthy animals and healthy soil, then we can't provide healthy meat. So we use holistic plant grazing, the grazing method that I've described. We spray our fields with a form of compost tea. Big thing is just we allow our fields to rest after we've grazed them for what almost seems like a ridiculously long time, but we've learned that that has really helped our land. Of all the decisions we're making on the ranch, it's just really focusing on how can we have healthy soil, because healthy soil is the foundation for all the other things.
Yeah, certainly. Now, what is the greatest challenge that's going on for you? Or has there been a persistent one through the past few years?
I don't think there's necessarily a certain challenge on our ranch, but I think it's nationwide, and that's just the attack on meat and beef. We've been told a lot of narratives about beef, some of which are true and some of which aren't. But at its core, beef is the most nutrient-dense food on the planet, and cattle just need grass and water, and they can convert that into a nutrient-dense protein. So I'd say just one of the challenges is just how much attack there is on that, but that's causing massive harm and a lot of unhealth.
And at the same time, the regenerative ag scene is certainly seems to be growing by leaps and bounds, and the awareness to certainly grass-finished beef is growing more and more, to the point where you all are caretaking the final time for finishing the cattle on grass. So the other ranchers in your area are picking up on your time that you've spent to really create a good finished product.
Yeah, we work with a lot of awesome, amazing ranchers that we collaborate with so that we can provide as many people with nutrient-dense grass-fed beef. And it's amazing how many like-minded ranchers who are passionate about the land and just who also do such an incredible job. For me, it's an honor to get to work with all of those incredible people and then also to provide that meat product to our customers.
Yes, absolutely. What is a favorite part of your day, Chloe?
Definitely any time that I get to move cattle, especially horseback. Like the other day, we had to move cattle across the highway and through our neighbors. It was just so nice to be out in nature and to see how healthy the animals are and see how much grass we have even after we grazed it. And there was birds and just the diversity and abundance of health.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, seeing some pictures of your ranch and you, was, wow, what a great place to spend your days, for sure. You know, I want to ask you about where you get your meat processed, and kind of a twofold question. Let me first ask you, is there a problem with getting your meat processed so you know it's your meat that goes in and you know it's your meat that comes out to be sold? I've heard of so many processing plants, and maybe this is only with large processing plants. It's hard to keep that separate.
Yeah, that's definitely a problem that I've also heard of and we've sometimes experienced in the past. Thankfully, we have a really amazing relationship with our butcher, and they do an incredible job. I can guarantee you, like, it's all our meat. I know the whole process, and they just have done an awesome job for us. So we feel very blessed that we have such an incredible butcher, because that's something that a lot of places struggle with.
Yeah. What's your favorite cut of meat?
Probably ground beef, because it's super nutrient dense, but it's super easy to cook.
I'm with you. That sounds good. Well, Chloe, is there anything else you'd like to share, either about your personal lifestyle or your ranch or a comment on regenerative agriculture?
I would just encourage people to connect and to know where their food is coming from, because we are so, so disconnected with that. And I believe that has caused a lot of unhealth and just a lot of problems. And I think figuring out and knowing the person who is raising your meat and asking the hard questions of, like, how many vaccines do you give your cattle and do they get antibiotics? What happens if one gets sick? And just asking those hard questions to really know who is raising your meat, especially beef, such a nutrient-dense food, but there's a lot of mystery around it too. So that's why going direct to a rancher is a great way to take out that mystery, and also most of the time it's way more flavorful than beef you just buy at the store.
Many thanks to Megan Lannan and Chloe Parker. Until next month, we can be found at cultivatedaudio.com, and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here with us and for helping make Here Where We All Want to Be.